Blog Talk Radio.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Blitzkrieg broadcast. It is March 21st, 2014. Thank you so much for joining me here at RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Please check out all the other great shows on this network, including our regular hosts and our roundtable and our wildcard hosts. Everybody's been doing a great job, and I just wanted to thank everybody who participated in the White Man March. We have much more coming up, so please go over to WhiteManMarch.com. For the latest. I've done a number of interviews, and I'd like to thank John Friend for having me on, Dave Gaheri, and also Stormfront Radio with Don Black. So it's been a lot of publicity and a lot of momentum we have been gaining here. Tonight, folks, I have a double header for you. This is going to be one hell of a show. First, I have Paul Fromm coming on the program, and then Eric Hunt will be returning for the second hour. He has some explosive, groundbreaking material that he just uncovered and would like to share on the show tonight. It's going to be an exclusive, so stay tuned. But first, I have Paul Fromm. Now, Paul Fromm is a Canadian free speech activist. He's active in the United States and travels around to Europe as well. He is somebody who has been in this game for quite some time, has been doing some great work. I met Paul out in California. I believe he's on the show right now. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Paul, good to speak to you again. I only got a few minutes to talk to you in California at the convention we both attended.
Right.
So it's great to finally have you on. I was wondering if you could give the audience just a quick background of who you are and when you started getting into your advocacy for people and for free speech in Canada and abroad.
Well, I guess my political activism began back around 1965 when I was about 15, and I've been active in a number of groups ever since. But for about the last 30 years, my two big focuses have been immigration reform and free speech. And so I'm the director of two groups, the Canada First Immigration Reform Committee and the Canadian Association for Free Expression. I like to say when people ask me, well, what are you all about? I'll say free speech and immigration. Not enough free speech and too much immigration. I guess I should clarify, immigration reform in the United States sometimes means finding a way to allow something like 12 to 20 million illegals into the United States and to legalize them somehow. Well, that's not what I mean. What we need in Canada, but I would say across North America, is a moratorium. That means cut it all off, minimum 5 years, as long as we've got a serious unemployment. And in Canada, it's about 7%. I think in the United States, it's close to that. Real figures, of course, are much higher because the unemployment figures don't include those whose benefits have run out or who didn't get any benefits in the first place. So the real unemployment figures, depending on whom you want to believe, could be anywhere from 12 to 15% rather than 7. But be that as it may, as long as we've got significant unemployment, we don't need any immigration, period. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, I sometimes say I'm an immigration reformer, but then I have to remember that in the United States, immigration reform sometimes means find a way to legalize the illegals, and I wouldn't want to be put in that category.
Right, and their reform also means increasing the number of non-whites who are allowed into the country each year legally. So they want amnesty for them, and they want to increase the number that is allowed in legally. This would be a very, very dangerous thing if it actually goes through. And it's a very hot topic, and people aren't really given a vote on any of these matters, not for any practical purposes. Now, in the 60s, pretty much Europe was still all white. Australia was white. New Zealand was white. And, of course, there were small minorities in these countries that were non-white. But over the past 50-so years, things have changed dramatically. And nobody got to vote on whether or not they wanted their countries flooded with non-whites. And around the same time that this immigration reform was going on, that made sure that all sorts of non-whites were allowed into formerly white countries and were actually given preference over white people in academia and in the workforce, we had the institution of hate speech policies. Now, these haven't fully kicked in here in the United States. Up in Canada, hate speech is something that is it's a problem. It's a problem because we don't have anybody's feelings.
Yeah,
when we're talking about how we don't, then it's illegal. Can you explain what the current situation is with free speech and hate speech in Canada, and also how your work has affected the situation there?
Well, yeah, you've touched on several important points. First of all, the immigration revolution, and that's what I call it, occurred in 1965 in Canada and the United States, and 1 year later in Australia. Kevin McDonald has done a magnificent job in his book, The Culture of Critique. And he has answered the question I think many Americans have asked, and certainly many Canadians have asked me, Paul, why did we change our immigration policy in 1965? Back in 65, Canada had more or less a Europeans and Britons only immigration policy, or not to be too cute about it, basically a whites only policy. Not absolutely entirely. There would be exceptions, but essentially, our Prime Minister in 1948, the then Prime Minister Mackenzie King, said the Canadians would not accept a change in the fundamental makeup of their population. And that was mainstream. No, Canadians didn't want to go from an almost all-white, with the exception of some Native Indians, European country. Now, our founders, settler people, were Europeans, no doubt about it. Our institutions, our languages, our political structures, our laws, we're European. We're a European country. There was nobody in the street back in 1965 saying, you know, we're sick and tired of being European. We're bored with being European. We want to let the whole world in, and we basically want to, over the next 80 years, replace ourselves. Nobody was saying that. It was the same in the United States. And what Kevin McDonald has pointed out in his book, The Culture of Critique, is that it was largely the result of years of lobbying by the Jewish lobby. For reasons we might get into if you want or not, but it was basically minority pressure. And you're quite right. Canadians had nothing to say about it. And Americans weren't consulted. There were a couple of U.S. senators in 1965 who raised a few objections. One wondered if a large influx from third world countries might replace American labor, and they were told, "Oh no, you don't have to worry about that." And another point of view raised by a couple of Southern senators was, might massive third world immigration upset the racial balance in the United States? And one of the senators, then a very junior senator from Massachusetts, Edward Kennedy, said, no way, there'd be just a few highly qualified professionals coming from third world countries, no need to worry your pretty heads about it. Well, of course, that's not the way it turned out. We are being subjected in Canada and the United States and Australia and New Zealand to, and in most of Europe, to massive third world population. It's replacement of our people. We basically are being genocided on the installment plan. And no serious demographer would challenge the following statement. By 2041 or 2042, the European founding settler people of the United States will be a minority. In Canada, it'll be about 2050 or perhaps a year or two earlier. We will have, in 85 years from the immigration revolution of 1965, in 80 or 85 years, have been overwhelmed and replaced, not by an invasion. I mean, not by the standard invasion of people with guns and superior arms overwhelming you, but by absolute treason from within. So, when I call myself an immigration reformer, I think I perhaps have to explain that. There's one other point you made. You're talking about illegals, and that is about as far as the immigration discussion goes in the United States. It makes me want to shake my head. Illegals, what are we even talking about? They're illegally in the United States. Throw them out. It's like having a discussion about armed robbery. What should we do about armed robberies? Well,
that sounds hateful. That sounds hateful. You can't just throw them out. It might upset them. They've got relatives here already that are now...
Shouldn't we arrest the fellow who's just knocked over a bank and pistol-whipped a little old lady and shot the manager?
Well, not if he's...
Well, no, I mean, he's got a wife and kids, too. I mean, he's got an ancient mama who depends on him. Most of us don't have a problem with that notion. As far as I'm concerned, you've told me they're illegal. Well, slap the cuffs on, toss them in detention, and throw them out.
Well, now they're not illegal, at least in regard to our press. Now they're undocumented. Undocumented migrants. And nobody's illegal. That's inhumane to label them as illegal. These are the kind of arguments that were being given. And illegals are in the Congress. They go into the Congress for these big demonstrations and protests. And, our congressmen, the traitors that they are, will bring in illegal aliens to make a statement about how this is right and just that we give them amnesty. It's absolutely sickening and disgusting. And I hear time and again now people arguing, well, America was never a white country. It's always been a melting pot. And, American Canada, that was stolen from the Indians. These aren't white countries. So you can't make the argument that this is genocide that's happening via mass immigration and assimilation. It's just evolution, as some people put it. It's absolutely disgusting.
Well, the people... there's no doubt there were native people in the United States and Canada when the white people returned in 1492 and the years following. We perhaps don't want to get into the fact that Europeans were in North America at least 20,000 years ago.
Yep.
But well, let's leave that aside. So Europeans descended on North America en masse in the years after 1492. The North America, the settlers found, was desperately primitive. The inhabitants were barely clinging on. There's all sorts of evidence of tribes that had been genocided, tribes that simply starved and went out of existence. The life of the so-called native people was not romantic or wonderful. It was, as Thomas Hobbes said, mean, nasty, brutish, and short. The North America we see around us with the roads, the railroads, the industry, the cities, the health care and all those things, all of it, the result of the European founding settler people. The North America, Canada, and the United States were not a product of multiculturalism. They were a product of European people, our ancestors. And to me, it's not much of an argument to say, well, the natives were here, not necessarily first, but they were here before us, so... everybody ought to be able to come. I think if you were to ask the average native how that grabbed him, he'd probably say no. If we had had the organization and the force, and we would have resisted more fully, and we didn't want to be caught.
Right. It's no justification to say that because North America is the result of colonization hundreds of years ago, that this means that we need to now open up our borders to anyone from anywhere as long as they're not white. This is trying to play upon white guilt to convince us that because of historical injustices, we've now got to embrace the entire third world. And it's just, well, it's idiocy, of course. But the argument that there are no white countries in the world, some people argue that Europe shouldn't even be all white because, oh, well, the Moors were there in Spain, well, of course, raping and pillaging, and other people make all sorts of historical revisionist arguments about how Europe used to be black or whatever, some idiocy, or we all come from Africa. There's all these kinds of justifications that people are giving as to why we now need to be blended out of existence and forced out of lands that our ancestors have been occupying for quite some time. And if you just look at the 1960s, America was almost 90% white. I'm guessing it was even higher in Canada. And so that constitutes a white country. I don't care what anybody else has to say. When you're that much of a majority, you can call it a white country, especially when all of the institutions within that country were based on white European values, ingenuity, and construction.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the other part of the immigration argument, which I don't think we hear too much about, is an overall immigration policy. So far, we've just been talking about illegals. We have to look at the, you know, even if we were to deport the, whatever, 12 to 20 million illegals in the United States, we would still have a problem with massive third world immigration. And that's where I think we have to have a discussion about immigration itself. First of all, is it a good thing at this time? And I think that there's where the answer is very simple. No, when you've got significant unemployment, as you do now, you know, roughly, give or take, about 7% in the United States, and roughly the same in Canada. And but we just had a federal budget, and it was predicted or forecast that unemployment may fall by about 0.1% in 2015 and 0.1% in the following year, so, and for 2014. So by 2015, we may be down to 6.8% unemployment. That's still a lot of people. And I think even, you know, if you want to even avoid the racial aspect, I think that alone should be enough to clinch the argument. And, you know, I think our people, or people in general, have been so dumbed down they can't think. But, you know, I try a simple approach with people. Now, look, okay, whoever he is, maybe he's Pedro or maybe he's Ranbir Singh or whoever he might be, if he comes to Canada and the United States, there are two and only two possibilities. Number one, Pedro gets a job. Hooray for Pedro. Great for Pedro. He's got a job. But that means that some American or Canadian remains unemployed. America and Canada lose.
And Pedro sends much of his money back to Mexico, so that money is not being spent within the United States at all.
That too, and that's the same pattern in Canada. The other possibility is Pedro doesn't get a job. You know, boo-hoo-hoo for Pedro. Well, we can't let him starve. You've got to put him on welfare. He's poor, so he can't afford housing, so you've got to put him in public housing. He's got 5 or 6 or 7 kids, well, they've got to be educated, medicated, social worker, policed. America loses. So either way, when you've got significant unemployment, immigration is a net loss. Whether the immigrant gets a job or doesn't get a job, America loses. That's what people have to understand.
American. Every American, every Canadian loses, not just the white ones, because it's usually people who have the lower-level jobs who are the ones that are replaced. So this is undercutting the labor of young black men, of young Hispanic, mestizo people who are already citizens within the United States. Illegal immigration is destroying this country in many different ways. It's not the only thing destroying us, but it's one hell of a symptom.
You're absolutely right, and American Negroes have been horribly abandoned by their leadership. I know there are small, or I mean, relatively, you know, unknown black leaders who have taken a stand on immigration, but well, you know, most of the big noises like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and the Congressional Black Caucus, they're all for it. But third world immigration really place those people first. It's an absolute, you know, disaster for blacks. And something we followed in Canada, and I suspect it's similar in the United States. There, the income of the middle class has been static for almost 25 years. In fact, there's a study out in Canada that in the last 25 years, allowing for inflation, the average middle-class Canadian is $56 better off than he was 25 years ago. That's why so many people feel, you know, I'm running faster just to stand still. And massive third-world immigration, legal or illegal, creates a huge pool of cheap labor, which keeps wages down, and makes it harder, ironically, for young white people to get their feet on the ground with a relatively secure job with a half decent income, so they can start a family. Mm-hmm. And that, in many ways, to me, is one of the worst results of massive third world immigration. That we're hurting our own people. We're hurting our own chances.
What a lot of white Republicans don't seem to understand is that it was the work of both the Democrats and the Republicans specifically benefiting from this cheap labor, and some of it white traders, and all, of course, cryptos who pretend to be white, that are really to blame for this situation. The Republican Party pretends to represent our interests, but oftentimes the businesses that support the Republican Party are all in favor of massive immigration, whether it's legal or illegal, because they have a new pool of laborers that they can pay next to nothing, pretty much close to slave laborers, because this is great for their bottom line. They don't really care about either their fellow white people or their fellow Americans. They care about the bottom dollar.
Yes, you know, and many of our people, and rightly so, see themselves as economic conservatives, prefer competitive free enterprise to, you know, to state-run socialism. And in that area, of course, I'd agree with them. But I think many of our people are somewhat naive. Cheap labor comes at a huge price. It may be cheap to have an illegal work at your particular business. You know, you can force them to maybe work below the minimum wage. Yeah, short term, it may be beneficial. The problem is, though, the damage to society. In the end, somebody will have to pay for that person's children's education. They may have to pay for their policing, for welfare, and so on. And that comes out of the general society. So, yes, for the ABC manufacturing company, Pedro working at the minimum wage may be a short-term benefit. But it doesn't benefit society in the long run.
Now, Paul, are people having this conversation out in the public, besides you and some other committed activists up there in Canada, or is this conversation somewhat being restricted because of your lack of free speech and the hate speech laws that exist there?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should mention that, because one of the things that was done in Canada is that in the very year that they changed the immigration laws, they began the process to bring in so-called anti-hate laws. It took another 6 years. The law didn't come in until 1971. But what I think the evil people who are behind it were thinking is, look, eventually the dummies are going to wake up to what's being done to them. and there's going to be protests. So what we've got to do is have laws in place that will outlaw hate speech, although they didn't call it that back then. They just called it hate. But and then you know, everybody thinks they know what hate is, but when you actually say, well, okay, could you define it? They don't know. And what you find is minorities will say that anything critical of them is hate. You know, like the homosexual lobby will say any criticism of the so-called homosexual behavior is homophobia. And, you know, any criticism of massive third world immigration means hate. Yeah, well, it doesn't mean that at all. But with hate laws, what you have is a big cudgel held over people's heads. And a lot of people don't know the law, I mean, like I do. I'm very, very, very aware of the hate law because we've been involved in fighting a number of cases over it. But most people have only a vague idea. And then when they hear, you know, criticism of immigration is hate, they shut up. Now, actually, it isn't. I mean, if you're, you know, as long as you don't use a lot of really bad language or something, yeah, you could probably make criticisms I may be making on your program tonight. But people don't know that. And so it's had the effect of putting a huge damper on criticism of immigration. And, of course, the poodle press is only too happy to start hollering racism and, you know, xenophobia and hate. If somebody does open their mouth critically of the third world immigration.
You know what's interesting is that people out there, white people, Jewish people such as Tim Wise, non-whites, they can all say the most vile things against the white race. They can be just completely hateful of us. I've seen somebody on C-SPAN, that radical black nationalist, saying he's trying to figure out how to kill, exterminate all the white people on the planet. People are there clapping. This isn't considered hate speech. It's ridiculous, and it shows the double standard. It shows that they're not really against hate. They're just against the white European people. And hopefully we can make this very clear that it's not really about stopping racism or hate. It's really just about shutting up white people and making sure that they can be disenfranchised without any real resistance.
There was a book, and I'm afraid I forget the title, but it came out about 20 years ago, and it outlined the homosexual agenda. And what the authors were very insistent about is this. You never debate. What you do is any criticism of the homosexual agenda, you immediately label it as hate. And that's going to be the conversation stopper. Just call it hate, and people will shut up because you know people are terrified of being called haters. And they learned that a long time ago with the immigration debate. Rather than talk about the facts or anything like that, just start screaming hate. You know, it's just because you hate people. It's not that we hate people at all. It's that we love our own people and don't want to see them swamped. Sometimes I like to put the case this way. Look, imagine somebody said, I think we should move 3 million Europeans to Jamaica. It's got a nice climate, a great place for retirement. It's too good for those Jamaicans. We should actually, over, let's say, a 50-year period, move a lot of European or white people down there to Jamaica and take the place over and make it ours. Well, anybody hearing that would say something like, you're proposing genocide. You would replace the Jamaicans. That's not only racism, it's genocide. That's a horrible thing today. You're genocidal even proposing such a terrible thing. And, you know, I would agree. That's exactly what that sort of proposal would be. Well, then, why is it perfectly all right to propose the overwhelming and genocide of my people?
Well, Paul, I wanted to get your take on the recent white man march that was this past Saturday, March 15, 2014, when people around the world got out there with the message that diversity, in quotation marks, equals white genocide. It's a very simple formula, and I think a lot more people now know this secret formula that's been used against us, and so it was very successful in many ways, at least in my opinion. What do you think about that message as a short, simple way to describe to people what is going on, and also perhaps we can get into some other ideas for activism that you might have for upcoming marches?
Well, I think the idea was genius. The White Man March was something that I think was very good because it was easily franchised. It didn't involve a lot of people having to converge on one area with all the organizational and other problems that that entails. I think it was franchised. You could do in your own local community what you wanted. It didn't have to be big. It could be just a small gathering if that's all you could muster. And it was something that everybody could participate in. And I think it was a good start. I was lucky enough to be able to organize and participate in an event in Penticton, British Columbia. Now that's in the interior of the province of British Columbia, in the Okanagan Valley. And we had a number of folks out, and we had the standard placard that diversity equals white genocide, we had a couple of short talks and so on. And knowing on the other side of Canada, in Kingston, Ontario, which is a university town about more or less opposite Rochester, New York, on Lake Ontario, there was a flyering campaign by a number of young folks handing out white pride leaflets under the rather grim eye of the police, who weren't too amused, but nothing too untoward happened. I think it's a great idea, and I think it's important to get across to the general public, who have heard generally only bad things about white pride. But white pride means pride. It doesn't mean putting down anybody else. White pride doesn't mean denigrating blacks or natives or anybody else. It's pride in our achievements. And I think it's an education thing, too, because a lot of our own people actually have no idea of why they ought to be proud. You know, our education system has really abused them. You ask the average grade 12 or high school senior, what did Europeans accomplish? What would you say about European civilization? Well, they'd probably scratch their head a little bit and say, well, I don't know. They genocided the Jews. They enslaved the blacks. They dispossessed people, and they raped the environment.
Yeah.
Every one of those is either an outright lie or largely false. So they know nothing about what our people achieved. They have some half-baked notions that we were running around with blue body paint or woad when the blacks had a thriving civilization in Egypt. Well,
yeah.
not true. Just a lot of hooey. I think even some of our own people need education as to why they ought to be proud. And being proud doesn't mean you call another group nasty names. Being proud is knowing what you stand for. Right? One of the things that floors a lot of people is the fact that 95% of all scientific patents ever issued were issued to Europeans or white North Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, almost all of modern science is a European thing.
And this comes from homogeneous societies of Europeans. It's much harder to really and perform at your best when there's enforced diversity within your lands, where people who are not as qualified are given preference over white people simply based upon the color of their skin. If you're not white, that gets you a lot more points on any kind of application. And so white people are being discriminated against, not given the same kinds of opportunities to excel in academia and the workforce. And so we're stifling our best and our brightest, not allowing them to get ahead. There was this policy, No Child Left Behind. The way I see it, because they're spending so much to corral the idiotic youth of all kinds and not spending enough to develop our best and brightest, it's actually not No Child Left Behind. It's No Child Gets Ahead. And so we've got this diversity problem. And in the educational system, in the workforce, wherever, we're told time and again, diversity is our greatest strength. Diversity is, it's joyous. It's love. Diversity is love. And so that's why I've been trying to educate people that diversity is not evolution. It's not our greatest strength. It's not love. Diversity is, in fact, white genocide. And that's backed up by the United Nations definition on genocide, because what we're seeing is forced or massive immigration and forced assimilation in only white countries. And what we're seeing is preference being given to these non-whites within these formerly white countries. And it's destroying us. We're not able to earn nearly as much money. We are downtrodden, abused, simply because we are white. We're made to have collective guilt. We are being collectively punished for the alleged sins of our forefathers. And as we've talked about before, white people are the only people who aren't allowed to say anything about the injustices taking place. So that's why we're standing up with the White Man March and moving ahead with it, saying, you know what, let's just call a spade. Diversity isn't any of these grandiose, universalistic type notions. It is white genocide.
Yeah, and diversity is really the Tower of Babel. You don't build a strong society with complete confusion. People bring values, and this is what a lot of people, a lot of proponents of multiculturalism and so on, don't know or are not prepared to recognize. Each culture has its own values, and multiculturalism, the gospel would say, well, all cultures are equal, but they're not. You know, not to be too extreme about it, but the culture of the headhunter isn't exactly the same as the culture that built Europe.
Or the advanced,
are not equal.
The advanced Asian cultures. They had some great architecture. It's different. You don't have to say that one is superior to the other to notice that there are significant differences. I myself, perhaps I have a little bias, I do find European civilization to be far superior to that it has existed in Africa and continues to exist this day. Almost anybody on the planet, including American blacks, would agree with that, because if you were to give them the option of going back to Africa, going to one of these countries that's run, you know, has been liberated from the white man and is run by blacks now, South Africa, which has the rape capital of the world, Johannesburg, and then there's Zimbabwe, a great tourist destination there, which used to be beautiful Rhodesia, or any of these other places, Liberia. They are absolute messes. And the average American black has about 50 times, up to 50 times the income that blacks have in Africa. So it goes to show just how strong white civilizations are and the standard of living that we are accustomed to, and which isn't privilege, it's been earned. It's just a byproduct. It is the production of our people. This is how we live, and this is how we do things. However, if our countries are flooded with people who do not share the same values, who do not build civilization in the same way, then we will no longer be first-world countries. In fact, we are now slipping into third-world multicultural hellholes. You go to any city, which used to be completely white, in the Western world, and this includes North America, Europe, they're almost they've almost all been flooded, and there are not as many white people to be found in any of the major important cities. And so it goes to show that not only is it wrong to genocide people, but it's wrong. Yeah, it's wrong, but it's not being opposed very much. People just ran away. The white people took the flight option instead of the fight. You know, originally they had to break out bayonets to get people to integrate in Dixie. They had to rough up some people, some mothers in Boston on the south side where the Irish women are, Irish families. But it was fairly easy to get people to kind of just roll over and move out as their displacement took place.
Yeah, and the many whites, after some initial resistance, took the flight route and moved to, if they could, if they had the money, moved to suburbs or in many parts of the South at great expense to themselves, sent their children to white academies, so they paid their taxes for black education and then had to pay out of their own pocket for their own children's education. And all the way along the line, unfortunately, our people were just terribly, terribly led. Our political class absolutely betrayed white people, imposing affirmative action and forced busing and so on.
Now they have the housing too, Section 8 housing, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development makes sure that there is not an area that is too white. If there is, it needs to be diversified. They don't do the same thing and find an area that's Asian or too whatever. It's only when it's too white that the area needs more diversity. And they'll use taxpayer money to make sure that this happens. Let's seek out any white enclaves and bring in the brothers.
I agree with you. I think another very useful thing to say to people that are all in favor of diversity is, can you point to me a diverse society that has worked? A multicultural society that has worked. And they'd be very hard-pressed to do it. Some people will say, well, the former Yugoslavia brought together these, diverse groups, the Croatians, the Serbs, and the Montenegrins, and the Slovenians, and so on, and different religions and different ethnicities. The only way, though, it worked was through brute force. The minute communism fell, these groups all sought independence and are still at each other's throats. Now, if people that are at least all white cannot get along, it's nothing but an act of faith, absolutely foolish act of faith that somehow we'll all just get together. I'm not sure if you're aware of where that slogan, diversity is our strength, our greatest strength, first came up. B'nai B'rith invented it. Yeah, the Anti-Defamation League for B'nai B'rith first used it back around 1994, and not long after it, in an address down in San Diego, then-President Bill Clinton used it. By this time, it had gone from diversity is our strength to diversity is our greatest strength. And then from then on, it's become a mantra. The Canadian Prime Minister, and I know him, he's not an idiot, has used it. He spoke to some UN gathering in Vancouver a few years ago, and he proclaimed, diversity is Canada's greatest strength. And I thought, if we had anybody with their brain in gear, they'd be laughing at you. Well, wouldn't Canada's greatest strength be our tremendous natural resources, the oil, the hydroelectric power, the coal, the wheat, or maybe a talented workforce, or or geographic location. But diversity is our greatest strength. I mean, you might as well say cancer is our greatest strength.
Well, you know what? I challenge anybody out there to think of one diverse city, to think of one diverse neighborhood that has a minority of white people that they would actually want to go and live in, that they'd feel safe in. Even the non-whites themselves agree that white neighborhoods, white towns, are the safest place that you can be, and that's why they move their families to white neighborhoods if they get the opportunity. So there isn't just white flight from the cities. There's also the most wealthy of the non-white populations who are fleeing these areas, trying to find a nice place where they can be safe in this multicultural cesspit.
You know, you're quite right about that. This is not obviously the first time anybody's noticed it, but I think it's something that should be repeated again and again, the hypocrisy of the proponents of diversity. Those who are the loudest about diversity and its great benefits don't live in Harlem. They don't live in East St. Louis or in Detroit or in, you know, as this is mostly an American audience, it might not know the undesirable areas of Toronto, but the Negro Jane Finch or certain parts of Scarborough. The advocates of diversity don't live with these people. They preach about it. And during the years in the United States when working class whites were being forced through busing into black schools or blacks bused into their schools, I noticed that people like Edward Kennedy and Bill Clinton didn't send their kids to a diverse school in the ghetto. You know, it's like it's okay for you, but of course not for me. Well, why is that? I mean, if diversity is really so great, why don't you, the advocate of diversity, live in Harlem or in Detroit?
It's a great point because pretty much the Northeast liberals for so long have, and of course the people out in Hollywood have for so long portrayed the Southern white man as being just so racist and backward, bigoted. And he just doesn't know the great character within black people. But these people, for the most part, are completely divorced from the reality of what black and white relations are really like. They don't live in it. They only see the movies. They only see the diversity that is represented within the elite schools oftentimes. So they go around Harvard or any of the Ivy League schools, these white idiots who think that they're smart, and the traitors, they go and they're interacting with the best of the best of all the non-white races. And they've never been to many areas in the South where it's not good. They don't know about the black-on-white epidemic of crime. So I think what we really need to do with our new media is to show people the reality, show how it doesn't match up to how things are being presented. You know, this is what diversity looks like on TV. Okay, this is what diversity looks like in the local news when such and such is happening. You know, so I do think that people are starting to see that we've been lied to a whole lot about some of these things, but we just need to make it more and more apparent to people that diversity is dangerous, diversity is killing us, and there is a better way, and white people are not to be held responsible for all of the world's ills. We should be allowed civil rights in this country, which are actually denied to us in the United States. We should be allowed to organize ourselves. We should be allowed to have pride in ourselves. So Paul, what do you think we could do, perhaps that has not been done already? Are there any ideas you have as to how to make some real breakthroughs to our people, whether it's through videos, whether shorter or longer, doing more of these radio shows? how can we get out there and do this? Is it really going to be the boots on the ground type activism that the White Man March is all about, or of course just a combination of everything?
Well, I don't think there's one size fits all. One thing I think we have to be on top of is the new social media. We have to be there, and I think to some extent the white nationalists have been there on the internet. It wasn't long before the enemies of free speech, like the Simon Wiesenthal Center, cottoned on to the fact that there was a lot of white nationalist websites, and this goes back to the mid 1990s. And they started in Canada and in the United States less successfully efforts to suppress these websites. But they realized, I think, even before a lot of our own people realized, just how powerful the internet was. By the mid 90s, the Zionists and the others who don't have the interests of our people at heart had pretty much taken control of most of the mass media. It would be very difficult to get a worthwhile story into most newspapers. Maybe not all. There were still a few holdouts like Pat Buchanan on a good day and a few others. Almost nothing on TV. There was some dissident radio, but most of these outlets tended to be fairly small. Every now and again somebody will say to me, you know what we need, Paul? We need to have our own newspaper. And I say, gosh darn it, you're right. And are you about to write a check for $2 million to start it up? Well, that ends the conversation pretty quickly. Yeah, of course, it would be wonderful if we had our own newspaper, we had this or that. But suddenly with the Internet, everybody could be his own publisher. And what has happened in the last 10 years with the radio you and I are doing right now, with YouTube? I didn't even know what YouTube was. I thought it was some part of discussing part of the abdomen. 6 years ago, until somebody said, it's this newfangled thing, you ought to do one. Well, okay, well, a couple of my friends and I put together a few YouTubes that are still up there, and that's where people are at. With relatively minimal technology and not a lot of money, we can be in the communications business in a way that would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. This is where I think it's at. I think we've got to be a lot more active on Twitter. I think we have to be a lot more active with YouTubes, which are not that difficult to put out. People who would never read a book, I advise people read Kevin MacDonald's Culture of Critique. Well, people will hear me, but I know very few will do it. We'll get ideas from a YouTube, and people like Representative Dr. David Duke have. That's where they're putting their efforts these days, knowing that that's what people are. People will watch that and learn. And
a lot of people do. A lot of people are watching the videos. They're reading the articles. We are becoming much bigger than some of the mainstream outlets online. It's quite astonishing for me to see. The About page at whitemanmarch.com had 20,000 Facebook likes on the day of the march. 20,000, that's huge. Sometimes a good New York Times piece that causes some controversy might have some thousands of likes, perhaps. I go over to whitegenocideproject.com, and their recent post about how Jesse Jackson wants less white people employed in Silicon Valley. He's going out and making sure that they even further diversify, trying to genocide any white people who might be trying to get involved in technology. He's trying to make sure that we don't have any high-paying jobs, that we cannot be influential whatsoever in any of the companies that are doing things in Silicon Valley. He's saying less white people, less white people. Well, 5,700 likes already on this, 5,700 likes. On this story, which only came out a couple days ago. It's amazing. It's amazing to see so many people reading these stories, commenting on them, feeling free to share this. People are now aware enough about white genocide to not even think twice about liking an article coming from White Genocide Project. This is how much we have been able to normalize our way of thinking. And it's really, really exciting that people no longer trust the mainstream and are looking for people like us to tell them the truth. Now, this obviously can be dangerous with controlled opposition and everything like that, but the activists now, the people who actually care, they've become very discerning, I think, and are able to filter through a lot of the BS that's out there for them, and we're really coming to the truth now. I think more and more people are really starting to see the kind of system that has been set up against them and are looking for ways to change it, to destroy it, and replace it. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more creativity coming forth from the white European people as they seek to reclaim their destinies. And I just, I love seeing all of the amazing things that come from a people who are impassioned.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And 20 years ago, if we'd been contemplating a white man march, first problem would be, well, we've got to get enough numbers to impress the media. We'd be mostly concerned about the media because we would only reach the public through the media. Well, the fact is we don't need them anymore. As I was saying to some of our friends across North America, do your thing. Make sure you've got some pictures. If you've got a video, so much the better. And slap it up there. We don't have to care what the New York Times or the other agents of the Poodle Press say. Never mind them. In fact, don't even invite them. Who cares? Put your information up there. And the younger generation, I'd say probably the people at least under 30, maybe even a bit older, more and more they're going to the internet for their information. They're not picking up the daily fish wrap to find out what's happening. Some are very cynical with good reason that they're not being told the truth, and others just know they get far more variety if they go online. And that's where we have to be. We no longer have to play the game. If I just have the sign, the right sort of sign, and use the right words in the press release, maybe they won't smear me too badly. Well, they're going to, knowing who controls them, they're going to smear you. It's going to be, neo-Nazi, white supremacist, anti-Semite. Did I mention neo-Nazi? You know what I mean? That's what the Poodle Press is going to say anyway. So we can, more and more, wherever possible, we ignore them and do an end run around them with the alternative media, and that's what you and I are doing.
Yeah, well, Paul, what's coming up for you next year, and how can people find what you're doing and keep up with you?
Okay, in the next year, we've got a couple of big hate cases in Canada, the Arthur Topham case. The best way to keep up with me, I guess, would be to email me. I'll put you on my list for regular grams, and my email is really simple. It's paul@paulfromm.com, and so that's paul@paulfromm.com. We also have a free speech website, which is http://cafe.nfshost.com. So cafe.nfshost.com, and you can keep track at least of our free speech activities. We've in the process of mounting a really good immigration website, but I don't have the URL on that for technical reasons right now. But you can keep up with me by emailing me and getting on my list, and that's paul@paulfromm.com. And we publish two newsletters, one's on free speech, one's on immigration. And you get in touch with me if you'd like me to mail you out sample copies. I'd be glad to do that.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. Really appreciate it. And let's keep in touch, and hopefully I'll be able to have you back on sometime in the future.
Well, we'll do that, and thanks a lot for having me, Kyle.
Quite welcome. Take care, Paul.
Okay.
And in the next hour, we'll be talking to Eric Hunt about his recent findings. And so we'll take a break. We're going to take the kind of leftist propaganda and use it for our own ends. We're looking for some volunteers, folks.